The Somali famine of 2011 triggered a humanitarian response which saved thousands of lives. Whilst agencies worked hard to help those most in need, they faced difficult political circumstances. A new report released this month by ODI and the Mogadishu-based Heritage Institute for Policy Studies revealed for the first time the extent of the compromises that aid agencies were forced to make in order to provide help. Based on a series of interviews with members of Al-Shabaab and agency workers in Somalia at the time, the report, Talking to the Other Side, established that some agencies paid up to $10,000 to access areas of Somalia which were under the control of Al-Shabaab militia. These payments were the consequences of a significant ethical conundrum, not helped by the role of US and UK counter-terror legislation in dictating what actions agencies can take when it comes to negotiating with groups identified as terrorists. I spoke with the report's authors, Ashley Jackson of the Humanitarian Policy Group at ODI and Abdi Ayanti of HIPS in Somalia, to find out more about the reality of aid work in Somalia over the last few years. Ashley Jackson sets out the dilemma.
The famine affected predominantly areas under Al-Shabaab control, and the dilemma for aid agencies was they were forced to make an impossible choice to choose between either staying and agreeing to Al-Shabaab's demands, which included paying thousands of dollars in registration fees. It also included limiting their interactions with beneficiary populations, limiting the involvement of women, or they could withdraw. The famine ultimately killed over 250,000 people, so literally it was a life and death choice that they were making.
Many people knew Al-Shabaab were making life difficult for aid agencies, but the systemic nature of their approach is best explained by Abdi Ayanti, who I spoke to over Skype from Mogadishu.
So Al-Shabaab has an office called the Humanitarian Coordination's Office, and the main task of that structure was to try and prevent any threat emanating from international aid agencies, but at the same time to try and monetize their activities in the Shabaab-held territories in southern and Somalia and central Somalia at the time. And so what the Humanitarian Coordination Agency of Al-Shabaab done then was to create an elaborate process whereby aid agencies were forced to register and pay sometimes considerable sums of money to operate in Somalia, but then also to be subject to intrusive monitoring by this agency that a number of times actually recruited some of the beneficiaries of the aid agencies to try and monitor and report what they're doing. But at the same time, really try and monetize their activity, not only from the standpoint of registration, but aid agencies would be asked to pay for traveling from one location to the other, or trying to build a structure somewhere, or starting a new operation in a new place.
So were the aid agencies prepared? Ashley Jackson says not.
What we found was that most aid agencies were remarkably ill-prepared to deal with Al-Shabaab's efforts to extort from them and to co-opt their actions. We found few agencies had a structured approach or strategy to dealing with Al-Shabaab. Those that did, however, managed more often than not to remain in the areas Al-Shabaab was present, to often avoid paying fees, and to reach, you know, populations affected by the famine.
So was preparation the main factor in determining which agencies fared better?
It was an extraordinarily difficult situation for aid agencies, and even those that were really well prepared faced impossible moral choices. But some agencies did manage to stay in Al-Shabaab territory, and some of them provided medical services, which Al-Shabaab was more receptive to, and that was one factor in enabling them to continue to help Somalis under Al-Shabaab control. Another factor was long-term presence. For those agencies that remained, many had been there for decades, since the early 90s. So they had been around during a previous famine, the famine of 91-92. And there was a memory that they were there, that they helped, that they did good for Somalis. And that helped them out ultimately when the next famine rolled around in 2011.
And did paying money to Al-Shabaab guarantee agencies access? Not so, according to Abdi.
It was not always the case, but it was an objective for the Humanitarian Coordination Office to extract as much money as possible from aid agencies, and oftentimes that equated greater access in the Shabaab-held territory. So while there was a causal effect between money and access, there was instances whereby some aid agencies were subjected to pay a considerably higher amount of money, but at the same time, the limitations that were put on them were quite pervasive and difficult.
Despite this, according to Ashley, it was often Somalis themselves at the negotiating table.
What often happened was when Al-Shabaab moved into a new area, took control of a town, they would move in to set up a civilian administration. They would approach aid agencies directly. So it was the aid workers on the ground in the villages and the towns of South Central Somalia that had the contact with Al-Shabaab. And they would proceed to negotiate. Al-Shabaab wanted to know about the aid agencies, wanted information, wanted to know about the programs. And so often all of this happened at a local level. And so it was Somalis themselves from those communities often negotiating with Al-Shabaab.
So, ultimately, were those agencies that potentially broke the law justified in doing so?
Well, the most important thing here is that there was a basic supply and demand. There was a very incredible need, huge need for humanitarian aid to reach to thousands of people. 268,000 people have died in the famine of 2011. And many of them died because aid agencies were not able to get through them. And if they were able to get through them, many of them would have been saved. So, you know, the dilemma that aid agencies were facing was understandable. And many of them feared that they would be prosecuted in countries in the U.S., such as the U.S. and so on, for counterterrorism or for money laundering or whatnot. But the fact of the matter is that they were able to reach thousands and tens of thousands of people.